Thanks. I'd like to thank the organizers for bringing us together and giving me a chance to speak for this nice conference. I want to talk about applying numerical renormalization group methods for quantum chemistry. And I'd like to start off by giving you some motivation. And since we're physicists here, I want to give you the physics motivation, which is longer term. Then I'll also tell you a little bit about sort of a chemistry motivation. My motivation for thinking about this sort of thing from a physics point of view stems mostly from thinking about the cuprates. And so the question is, where are we in thinking about strongly correlated systems? And really, I mean thinking mostly about the cuprates in terms of applying numerical methods. We have had a lot of developments in powerful numerical techniques in the last 10 or 15 years. And so we can certainly do much better than we used to be able to do. As we've applied these techniques to the cuprates, we found that the systems are a lot more complicated than we originally thought. And so now we have all sorts of things going on, like stripes and competing with superconductivity, et cetera. One of the characteristics is that the models that we're simulating are very sensitive to small changes in them. What I like to think of it is that the first order parameters of these models, basically T and J or T and U, are well understood. We know their values pretty well. We can study them. Then there are second order parameters. For instance, the next nearest neighbor hopping T prime in the diagonal direction, we have some understanding of the value that might take for the cuprates. But it has a small numerical value, and when you actually simulate with it, you find that there's rather large effects from this term. In fact, it can destabilize stripes, enhance pairing, or destroy pairing, all by changes of, say, of the order 0.2 in units of hopping T for this small parameter T prime. Now, if we think about other parameters that we don't know as much about, particularly involving two-particle terms, those could also have very strong effects, and we just don't know much about them. And so given that the models are behaving very sensitively to these parameters, we sort of have a little bit of a problem in trying to make real predictions. Of course, we can just explore models and look for terms that seem to have large effect. But it's not quite as satisfying as really knowing a good model to start with and then being able to look for solutions of it. So I think we need to connect back more to ab initio calculations. And we've seen that in this conference, that lots of other people are applying the same sort of idea to other systems. And we've seen LDA plus U models, and I mean that in sort of a general sense, LDA plus U and J and solved by DMFT, et cetera. And that certainly seems like a step in the right direction. There's still a little bit of arbitrariness in what parameters you choose to put into those treatments. And it would certainly be nice to put it on a more fundamental foundation, which I think has to be the renormalization group. So what we should think about starting with some sort of ab initio all-electron calculation and then integrating out high and low high energy parts of that and deriving models that we could then study. And of course, it's a very ambitious thing, but that's sort of the direction I've been trying to go. Okay, so that's a little bit of the physics motivation. From the chemistry side, if you look at what's happening in quantum chemistry, the chemists use density functional methods quite a bit, and for systems which aren't too strongly correlated, those work well enough, and they can do large systems. If you can, in a sense, define a system as being strongly correlated if, say, LDA or LDA and GGA don't work well enough. If you look at these more strongly correlated systems, we have more traditional quantum chemical methods. The problem with these is that they can only be applied on small systems, as we saw in the last talk, in a number of examples. And in fact, the more strongly correlated they are, the smaller the system that you have. And so in fact, there are diatomic molecules which have no good treatment for, say, the potential energy curve of the separation between them. Nothing that really is quantitatively accurate in comparison with experiment. Okay, so if you look and see what methods are present in quantum chemistry, there are some sophisticated methods, some sophisticated diagrammatic perturbation theory. There's a couple clustered methods which are sophisticated, but the renormalization group has had almost no presence in quantum chemistry. Okay, so my goal has been to change that and introduce ideas from the renormalization group into these calculations, starting with DMRG and applying that in sort of a straightforward way to quantum chemistry. In the second part of the talk, in applying DMRG to ab initio calculations, I found an inefficiency in it that sort of called out for another method to set up the calculation before you did DMRG. And so there's a nice method based on canonical transformations that are done numerically that it makes a nice method to use in conjunction with DMRG. So that'll be the second part of this talk. Okay, so let me start off by telling you a little bit of very basic quantum chemistry in terms of the electronic structure approaches. Usually one uses localized basis sets which are centered on each nucleus. Usually they're formed from linear combinations of Gaussians times a spherical harmonic. And these are non-orthogonal, so you need to immediately calculate an overlap matrix and you can construct an orthogonal single particle basis. And then normally all calculations start with a Hartree-Fock calculation within that basis, usually called SCF, self-consistent field. We're used to thinking of Hartree-Fock as just determining a wave function where you only look at the orbitals that actually have electrons in them. But when you set this up as the chemists do, there's actually a matrix called the Fock matrix, which you can diagonalize, and it gives you not only the filled orbitals, but it gives you a complete set. So when you do Hartree-Fock in quantum chemistry, you're not throwing away any information. You just have a whole set of unoccupied orbitals, which you can then use for correlation. So once you've done the Hartree-Fock, you have this set of basis functions. And they're all orthogonal, and you can immediately write down the Hamiltonian in this basis. And it looks like a typical solid state Hamiltonian, except that it has an incredible number of non-zero terms here. So if the number of basis functions is n, then there's n to the fourth terms that you have to deal with for the electron-electron interaction. Okay, let me show you, just explain one of the early and easy to understand correlation techniques for going beyond Hartree-Fock, which is the configuration interaction method. So we form a subspace, and then we're going to do a diagonalization within that subspace, say with the Langshaus method. In that subspace, we put the Hartree-Fock state, and then we put single excitations, which involve taking an electron from below the Fermi surface to above, to any of the possible orbitals above. And then double excitations would be taking two electrons and putting them above. So we form a subspace with this, and then we diagonalize within that subspace. So very simple. This is not used that much anymore. It's not as good as more modern methods like the coupled cluster methods, but this is easy to understand. Okay, and it is justified to a certain extent within by perturbation theory in terms of thinking of the electron-electron interaction as being small. Another method is multi-reference CI, where you don't just start with one Hartree-Fock state, but you start with several starting states, and you do excitations relative to those. Okay, so instead of doing configuration interaction or coupled clustered methods, we want to apply DMRG to this same quantum system in this chemical basis. Okay, so let me say a little bit about DMRG. It's based on the numerical RG developed by Wilson to solve the Kondo impurity problem. And the idea is to diagonalize a many-body Hamiltonian a small part at a time. And each time you diagonalize it, you throw away parts of the system, think of it as high-energy states, and get a new effective Hamiltonian. And then you increase the size of the system by adding another degree of freedom to it, until eventually you have the full degrees of freedom of the problem that you're interested in. Or until, in some cases, you just continue on and look for fixed points. Now this numerical RG only works well for the sorts of problems that Wilson originally applied it to, impurity problems. If you think about applying it to lattice systems, it doesn't work well at all, because the separation of the states that you keep and the ones you throw away is done by energy. And in lattice systems, there's no hierarchy of energy levels, and so different states on different blocks of a lattice have all sorts of mixtures of different energies in them. And so it turns out to be a terrible approximation. In DMRG, there's a much better approximation that involves throwing away states essentially by low probability. So you can calculate a particular density matrix and diagonalize it, and then the eigenvalues that you get are the probabilities of many-body states. And so you can throw away states by low probability, even if their energy scales are not at all sensibly arranged. Now, in order to make this work, it's a complicated arrangement that involves an iterative procedure. The main point for this talk is that it's designed for a one-dimensional system. So we think of having a one-dimensional Hubbard model or Heisenberg model, and then we're going to sweep back and forth through the system with this procedure involving doing the renormalization on one side of the system and then doing it on the other side. If you want to do two dimensions, you have to map that onto a one-dimensional chain, which you can do as long as you take a finite width in one direction. However, it's a little bit unnatural, or quite a bit unnatural, and what's problematic about it is that these sorts of long-range couplings here introduce significant errors into the calculation. And so for two dimensions, as we make this width wider and make these couplings here longer and longer ranged, we lose accuracy. Okay, but I'm not going to show you any more, I'm not going to show you any, actual TJ or Hubbard model type of calculations. I'm going to go now to applying this to quantum chemistry. Okay, so we're going to apply it in sort of a completely straightforward way. It's very natural within DMRG, and then the only thing is that you need some numerical tricks in order to make it efficient to deal with so many terms in the Hamiltonian. So we're going to map each Hartree-Fock orbital we'll think of as a site. And so we might have these orbitals arranged in energy. Well, we'll just lay them down and think of them as a one-dimensional lattice. Now, when you do that, you get long-range couplings across through the lattice, and so that's going to be a source of error. And so the idea is to try this and see whether those errors can be controlled. Now, you don't have to lay them out in order of energy. The most important principle is to keep the strongly interacting orbitals close together, because if they're close together, once they're subsumed within a block, the strength of their interactions doesn't matter any longer. So it's only the couplings between two different blocks, when you divide the system in two, that matter. Okay, so there are various ways of ordering this. I won't go into more details about it. Then I don't want to say too much more about this, but this is a set of tricks involved, really one important trick that reduce the calculation time by a factor of the number of orbitals squared overall. And The main thing I should mention is that the main trick is was first invented by Tao Zhang in applying DMRG to momentum space. What you do is, you look at this term here, this is the electron-electron interaction term, but it's missing a Ci sigma, and it's missing the sum on I. Okay, and what you do is you sum all of these terms together, and then that's something that groups with Ci. And you sum all these terms together where you're just looking at the terms where J, K, and L are in the same side of the system, say the right block. And for those terms, you can write this complicated Hamiltonian in terms of that operator as this. Okay. So of course, it's a sort of a trivial rewriting, but if you implement it numerically, it gives you an enormous savings in the calculation. Okay, so let me just cut to the final status of the calculation time. Okay, the final calculation time is in terms of where n is the number of orbitals and m is the number of states per block that you keep, which in the examples I'll show you is can range from, say, 100 to 1,000. So generally, it's bigger than the number of orbitals. We have a term that goes as n cubed, and another term is n to the fourth and m squared. Since m is usually bigger, this is the dominant term. There's an n to the fifth, which comes from just changing the Hartree-Fock basis, and this is usually negligible. This is roughly comparable to many of the quantum chemistry methods, and so we can do somewhat similar size systems, but the behavior of the errors in the calculation is quite different. Now, all of this assumes that we're looking at a system where all of the orbitals are delocalized. If we went to the case where we had lots of atoms and localized orbitals on each atom, then it's possible that we could get a scaling which is linear in the number of atoms. This would require complicated bookkeeping for dealing with the long-range Coulomb interaction, but this is in principle possible. Okay, so let me show you some results for applying DMRG to a sort of typical quantum system. This is just one water molecule in a fairly small basis. The reason I'm doing this comparison is that this is one of the biggest systems that people could do the equivalent of a Langshow's calculation, a full CI, and so we can compare to an exact result. We're not comparing to an experimental result for water because we're working within a finite basis. And so we're just trying to reproduce the exact result within a particular finite basis. So the energy from the Hartree-Fock approximation is up here. The dashed line is the exact result from this full CI. The number m is the number of states per block that we're keeping, which is the parameter that we normally control within DMRG. Here's a particular configuration interaction calculation, which is not an especially good one. Let me show you a blown-up scale of this, which shows some more accurate calculations. In particular, one of the most accurate calculations is the multi-reference CI. So that's shown here. So DMRG gets better. DMRG is variational, so it's always an upper bound to the energy. Passes that around 100 states. This is just an estimated correction that they put onto MRCI, which drives it down here, which is not variational. But you can see that compared to these techniques, DMRG is able to achieve an accuracy, at least for these small systems, which is better than any of the standard quantum chemistry approaches. But that's for systems which are fairly small. And so what I've shown you so far is that sometimes full CI is used for benchmark calculations on these molecules. Well, DMRG can certainly do larger systems than full CI, and we can get essentially exact results to compare with. Okay. Now, many of these methods.
Steve?
Yes. Yes. Well, that was the significance of that limitation was that that was the largest system that could be done with and where you could get an exact benchmark calculation to compare with. So we're comparing within a particular basis, so we need the exact result within that basis. So of course we want to do much larger systems, and I'll get to that. Okay, now many of the quantum chemistry methods can be justified on the basis of perturbation theory, where the Hartree-Fock wave function is assumed to be a good approximation. In order to get away from that, you can take the water molecule and start breaking its bonds. In that case, Hartree-Fock doesn't work very well. And so in this case, the configuration interaction is dependent upon that working well, and it stops working so well. DMRG doesn't really care about broken bonds, and so it does just as well. In fact, it even does a little bit better in this particular case by 20% or so compared to the equilibrium case. So it does quite well. Okay, now when you try to scale up these calculations, what you find is that there's an inefficiency in DMRG that you'd like to avoid. And the particular direction that I've tried to scale these up is still small molecules, but more complete basis sets in order to find the true correlation energy as opposed to just a basis set limited correlation energy. And when you do that, of course, there are core levels, which are quite below the Fermi energy and very large distances below, and your basis set will have very highly excited energy levels. And if you think about how DMRG is set up, just sorting them all into one dimension, it treats them all the same. And so it's very inefficient because these orbitals are almost always completely doubly occupied, and the ones high above are almost always completely empty. So if you're from a solid state point of view, if you listen very carefully, you can hear these orbitals above and below crying out to you, "Integrate me out, integrate me out." And so the first question is there some way of doing a crude integration out within DMRG of these orbitals that doesn't treat them in this sort of as if they were strongly correlated, so it was more efficient. I couldn't think of one, but eventually I realized that there's a completely different approach which can remove these sorts of orbitals in a very nice way. And this is based on methods that we're very familiar with, namely canonical or unitary transformations, the same sort of methods that we use to go from the Hubbard model to the TJ model, or the Anderson model to the Kondo model. And the difference here is that I'm going to be talking about implementing these as a numerical method. Okay. Now, this was actually first done back in 1994. There was a particular technique called the flow equation method, which was a particular realization of these canonical transformations. It's called the flow equation method, at least in solid state physics. It's called similarity renormalization in particle physics, invented by Wegener and then separately by Glashek and Ken Wilson. In this approach, you end up solving a differential equation for the Hamiltonian itself as an operator, and the Hamiltonian changes as a function of what I like to think of as a time, the Hamiltonian keeps the same eigenvalues, and at each time it's related to the original Hamiltonian by a unitary transformation. And so the differential equation involves this commutator with this generator of the transformation. This is always gives you a unitary evolution as long as A of t is anti-Hermitian. And in this particular case, in Wegener's original development, he took the generator to be the commutator of the diagonal part of the Hamiltonian with the Hamiltonian itself. Now, I was actually unaware of this work when I was thinking about quantum chemistry and trying to find a method. So I reinvented the wheel a little bit, and I didn't reinvent the same wheel. I invented a slightly different method, which I think is a little bit easier to understand. So I'm going to explain that method to you rather than trying to give you more insight into this flow equation method. In fact, as a practical tool, they're both very similar. Okay, so the technique that I want to explain, I call Jacobi canonical diagonalization. So these general numerical canonical transformation techniques I've been calling canonical diagonalization. But this method is based on the Jacobi method for diagonalizing an ordinary numerical matrix. Okay, so how does that Jacobi method work? Well, it's a sequence of orthogonal transformations of a Hamiltonian where you just rotate away one particular off-diagonal element by using a 2x2 orthogonal matrix. And so the matrix is just this familiar form with cosines and sines, which actually can be written as the exponential of this anti-symmetric matrix. And so we just apply this to the rows and columns, the two rows and columns that we want to remove the element from, and we choose this as the rotation angle. Okay, so now the idea here is to apply this to a many-body Hamiltonian written in second quantized form. And we want to remove off-diagonal elements from that many-body Hamiltonian. First of all, we have to see, well, what are we going to remove? We're going to remove something which is off-diagonal, and what that means is that we want terms which are different from their Hermitian conjugates. Okay, so if a term can be written in purely in terms of density operators, then it's a diagonal term and we can't remove it. Otherwise, it's off-diagonal and we can remove it. So in order to remove it, okay, and again, an analogy with this matrix here, this anti-symmetric matrix, we're going to make an anti-Hermitian operator. We're going to take this term. When we do this, we remove both the term and its Hermitian conjugate, but instead of adding them together, we subtract them, put in an arbitrary angle theta in place of the coefficient A, and then we rotate in terms of using this well-known equation. Now, if you do this as an analytic method, as a perturbative method, generally you stop after a term or two. But doing this numerically, we can continue this expansion here until the actual numerical coefficients are as small as we like, say 10 to the minus 8. Okay, so that's one of the powers of the numerical method, is that it's not limited to a certain order in perturbation theory. The angle that we choose is given by this formula. There's some ambiguity in the choice of energies that we're using because we're working with operators instead of a simple matrix. But in fact, there is a good reasonable choice for these energies. And so you can have this angle be well defined. But the point is that even if you don't choose the right angle, it's an iterative method. We perform the canonical transformation, and then if that term isn't set exactly to zero, well, we can do it again, rotate again. And what we're trying to do is drive off-diagonal terms in the Hamiltonian to zero. Okay. Now, as you do each rotation, just as in the matrix case, a given rotation will introduce non-zero values to things that you previously zeroed. So you have to do it iteratively. Okay, now how do we implement this sort of thing numerically? It's the sort of thing that you could imagine doing with Mathematica. We've got these terms, C daggers and Cs. We're used to doing them by hand. You can teach Mathematica how to manipulate them using its non-commutative multiply. It's much more efficient to do this in C++ instead of Mathematica. So one way to implement it is you can encode each C or C dagger using one byte, or for a big system, two bytes. And then an array of these bytes is one term, and you can write routines to put them in, to take commutators and put them in normal ordered form, etc. And then you can basically do a big many-body term and do all the things that I've written down numerically. Now, when you do this, when you take a two-particle term, like the electron-electron interaction, commute it with another two-particle term, you get a three-particle term. And for a small system, you can keep all the terms. And then it's somewhat like a Langshow's exact diagonalization of the system, and you can get the exact energy. But for reasonable systems, you need to do a truncation of terms, and the simplest thing you might imagine is to just discard all of the three-particle and four-particle, et cetera, terms. Now, it turns out that if you make a judicious selection of which many-body terms you're going to remove, leaving the hard ones for DMRG, that this approximation works extremely well. So this sort of approximation can do a rather nice job and still get you very accurate energies, accurate enough for demanding chemical experiments. So I'll just be showing you results with a truncation of all three and more particle terms. Okay, then the question is, what terms do we rotate away? Now, I've introduced this as a way of removing just high energy orbitals and low energy orbitals, but if your system is not very strongly interacting, you can actually solve the entire system this way. Okay, so let's imagine that it's not very strongly interacting, and what that means is that the Hartree-Fock state has some reasonable overlap with the true ground state. Okay, then what do? You're going to remove all the off-diagonal terms which connect to the Hartree-Fock ground state, so that when they act on the Hartree-Fock ground state, they don't they give a non-zero result. So, for instance, for this term, in order for that to be true, index L and index K have to be below the Fermi level, and then I and J have to be above. And if that's true, then this is a term that you want to remove. And you remove them in pairs, so you have to remove its Hermitian conjugate. Now, if you go through this and you remove all of these sorts of terms, and all the ones that are generated successively, then for the transformed Hamiltonian, the Hartree-Fock ground state turns out to be the exact ground state of that system. Okay. So let me show you some results for doing that. Oh, let me say one more thing before that. I described how you can do this as a very general way in terms of these bytes representing C's, etc. Once you decide that you're only going to keep one and two particle terms, you can write it in a matrix formulation, but the complication, because you have to put things in a normal ordered form with a standard ordering of the orbitals, the number of terms that are involved is sort of enormous. So I ended up writing a program which generated another program. The generated program had 20,000 lines that did all of the possible matrix loops involved in taking a commutator of one of these terms. So there's some messy computer algebra involved. Okay. So back to this water molecule. Again, in the same basis in the equilibrium geometry. This is applying this numerical canonical transformation method to try to get the ground state. And so on the x-axis we have the number of Jacobi rotations that I've done. And as the Hamiltonian transforms, the Hartree-Fock energy for that Hamiltonian converges to an approximation to the ground state energy. So the exact result is here, and we see a convergence to the ground state, except that there's a small error involved. This error is typically, in this case, it's a few millihartrees. With a slightly different method, we can get errors that are typically about 1 millihartree. So that's really quite accurate. That's a fraction of a tenth of an eV. Now, you can also take the Hamiltonian at each stage of the renormalization and calculate its energy not just by looking at the Hartree-Fock energy, but by looking at second-order perturbation theory, the very simplest second-order perturbation theory formula you can apply to the system. Takes very little time to evaluate, and if you do this, what you find is that that actually converges to the same energy, but much more rapidly. As soon as you've removed all those off-diagonal terms, you've removed all the terms that contribute to this second-order contribution to the energy. But in fact, as you remove the largest terms, you're actually making this Hamiltonian better behaved, so that perturbation theory actually works much better very early on. So it's a way of making this, getting the answer more quickly. Okay, now that's with this Jacobi method. The results with the method developed by Wegener are very similar. So this is the flow equation method, where you solve a differential equation to evolve the Hamiltonian. Okay, so I put dots here. Well, those are actually time steps, and this is really a continuous evolution, which I just integrated with a certain step size. And so we see the Hartree-Fock energy again evolving to something that's very close to the exact energy as a function of this fictitious time. Okay, so this method gives somewhat better results. This is around 1 millihartree. And again, this is just throwing away all three particle terms. Now, I showed you DMRG results with a stretched water molecule where the bonds were being broken. And so that's a more rigorous test, and that shows the limitation of doing this numerical canonical transformations. So here we have this flow equation method, but with the bonds stretched. And it not only gives a bad approximation, it actually is an unstable evolution. So this is the error in the energy in units of Hartrees, and it starts to go down, but then there's some terms that sort of reinforce each other and drive a divergence, and so your energy actually goes to negative infinity. Okay, so this method either works very well or it completely diverges. Okay, now So what do you do in this sort of case? Well, this is where you really want to couple this method to another method. Oh, I should add that for this particular case, this is a small enough system that you can keep 3 and 4 particle terms, and you can make this converge very accurately to the right result. But it's a limited procedure that it's hard to make work on a larger system. So on a larger system, we'd really like to use this sort of canonical transformation procedure as something to do before you do DMRG. Okay, so this is the second way when we can use these. Suppose we want to integrate out an orbital which is high in energy. Okay, what you do is you remove all of the terms in exactly the same way, but you remove the terms which change the occupancy of the orbital that you want to move, or the set of orbitals that you want to move. What that means is that you integrate out the terms which have a C sub k or a C dagger sub k, but not both. If they have both, they won't matter. Now, once you remove those terms, you find that the Hamiltonian commutes with the number operator for these orbitals. And so then we can choose to consider only the sector of the Hamiltonian where the number operator is 0. We could choose to look in the one where it's 2, for one spin it would just be 1. We could choose that, but if it's a core orbital, we'll choose to work in the sector where it's 1, and if it's a high-lying orbital, we'll choose to work in the sector where it's 0. Okay, once you do that, you can discard, if it's a core orbital, you just replace the operator by a C number, 1, And if it's a high-lying orbital, you just throw away all terms that have that orbital. Okay, so it gives us a nice way of integrating out orbitals. Now, I've applied this quite a bit, and it works very well, although I only have one small table to show you results for. And in fact, I've applied this method to much bigger systems. So I've applied this method to systems with, say, 100 basis functions. And it's very reliable, and it doesn't depend on whether the system you're looking at is strongly correlated or not. And you can easily get on the order of, say, 1 millihartree accuracy. Okay, but I just happen to have only just a very limited table here to show you the results. So again, this is for H2O with 25 basis functions. But I want to remove a certain number of orbitals with the canonical transformation. Then I do DMRG on the resulting Hamiltonian, and I look at how big an error I get. And if I do up to about half of the orbitals in this particular basis, I get a really negligible error. And then once I start to remove more of those, I get a more significant error. It doesn't ever completely die and give a horrible answer, even removing all but four of the orbitals. So it doesn't share this divergence of trying to do the whole problem. So anyway, so far the results are quite encouraging with this. And so if we look at what I can do, which is a lot more than this particular table shows, it looks like we're now approaching what the best scaling up to systems with, say, 100 orbitals, or perhaps we'll be able to do 200 orbitals, we'll be able to solve them quite accurately, and it looks like we'll soon surpass many of the quantum chemistry methods for these sort of larger systems.
Yeah. Why it's not monotonic? So you see, when you remove 21 orbitals, the difference is slower than you.
Yeah. So this procedure isn't variational, and so there's no reason for it to be monotonic, and in fact it's not. But I don't really have any more detailed understanding of that. Okay, but as you can see, this is still very early in this these types of methods. So let me just conclude. Okay, so if we look at DMRG alone applied to quantum chemistry, we can get very accurate results. We're limited to, say, 60 or 70 basis functions if we want high accuracy. If we want to do larger systems, then we can do this numerical canonical transformation techniques, and in particular, you can use these in terms of as a hybrid method with DMRG. And that works very well, so that I think that the techniques are now good enough so that the main thing is just if we improve the programs a bit, we'll have a big impact on quantum chemistry. Of course, for the long term, we want to get to much larger systems, you know, thinking about localized basis functions. I think the whole RG approach has very strong applications to quantum chemistry. The chemists have been thinking just about wave functions rather than Hamiltonians, and it's very profitable to think about renormalizing the Hamiltonians. And so at least as one possible approach for doing big, realistic, strongly correlated systems, I think this is a nice way to go. In particular, this numerical canonical transformations, you can think about applying simply to, say, a copper-oxygen lattice and deriving the TJ model or the Hubbard model in a more controlled way rather than just doing it in terms of perturbation theory or in terms of fitting some simulations. It could be a very nice approach in general for deriving model systems in a sort of a controlled way. Okay, thanks.
Questions? store those n to the fourth terms? I mean, it seems to be that that's a thing that people, many bodies here, are not used to. They just keep the Hubbard term, which is very easy to store.
Right. Well, we're right. We're working within a basis, so there's a finite number of them, and what you can so I have more than one version of the program. One is more general, the other one is more specific. The general one, you have just a set of all the terms of the Hamiltonian, and there may be a million of them. Each one has encoded in some bytes the information of what term it is, which C daggers come where. And so you can work with this big list, and you can do calculations of the order of this water molecule with that. Even if there's a million terms, you can do that. Once you decide that on what sort of truncation you're going to do, then you can set up matrices that keep only the terms that you're going to use. And so then you just have a mapping between, say, a vector each element will correspond to a particular Hamiltonian term, and you store the mapping, and you just have to work out the relationships when you get a new term to decide where it goes.
Yeah. Walter.
If you have a system consisting of many different atoms, so not a periodic system, but a general many atom system.
Right.
And if you want a certain accuracy, can you say something about, for a given accuracy for such many atom systems, what is the n dependence, where n is the number of atoms?
Right. Okay, let me take the best case. So DMRG is set up to work for chain systems. So let me imagine doing a calculation on a polymer as sort of the nice case. So long.
Tell me about the three-dimensional system.
Yes, okay, but on the long length scale, it looks one-dimensional. On the short length scale, it looks three-dimensional. Okay, and so what you would do is you would set up you would use local basis functions. You would orthogonalize them in a way that preserves the locality, and you would do calculations. You could integrate out core orbitals and highly excited orbitals on each atom. You would essentially be deriving in a systematic way a pseudopotential for the system. Okay, and you would carry that out as far as your accuracy allowed. You'd set some cutoff, and that cutoff would tell you, for a given approximation of what kinds of terms you're keeping, it would tell you how many orbitals you could remove. Okay, so you would be left with a certain number of orbitals near the Fermi level for each atom, and then you string them together and you do DMRG. Now, in that sort of case, if you really go to large N, DMRG, the long-range Coulomb part of that can introduce an N squared, but if you're clever, you should be able to turn that to an N dependence. So in principle, it can be, for a long chain, it can be an order N method. For a three-dimensional system, it's much more problematic because DMRG is not set up as well for higher dimensions. You might think of this more naturally as being, you could do the canonical transfer formations as a way of setting up, say, a DMFT calculation. That might be more natural, but we really don't have any experience in that. So it's all sort of hypothetical in terms of this asymptotic limit, because we're fairly far from that right now.
Other questions?
How efficient this method compared to CI? I mean, term of CPU and storage, and
right,
and also whether it actually can work on systems where you don't have results of CI, for example. How
right.
reliable is this method then?
Right. The first of all, the calculation time. The chemists have written very nice programs, and so that makes it hard to compare, because they've worked on the same methods, improving them for 20 years, and. So it's hard to compare directly, but we aren't so far from that. just in terms of computational efficiency. You can write down what the particular calculation time is. Our DMRG programs are efficient. The canonical transformation ones are not very optimized. That's tricky to optimize. Now, in terms of reliability, there's still a lot more to learn in terms of, for instance, the effect of reordering the orbitals on the results. And it's still somewhat, it's not very much of a black box. But a number of other groups have followed up on just the DMRG application to quantum chemical systems. And so a number of groups have now utilized it very successfully in terms of solving a number of sorts of benchmark problems. Many of them, well beyond what you can do with the full CI calculation, but comparing with some, say, the advanced coupled cluster methods. And so it works quite well. We still have more to learn in order to make it. It's far from a black box, but it's doing rather well compared to the quantum chemistry methods.
Okay, so if there is no other question, let's thank Steve again for nice.
So, and also probably all the speakers on the conference and ITP staff, which makes this conference very nicely organized. I think Antoine want to say at least one word.
Well, I just would like again to thank all the speakers and the participants, and I hope you had a good time here.